1, 2, 3.
Welcome to In the Studio, a 21st century look at the greatest rock bands in history. I'm Redbeard, and today in the studio, rock royalty rules the Academy Awards and breaks box office records worldwide with Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody. When the 91st Annual Academy Awards telecast opened live from Hollywood, broadcast worldwide to an estimated 100 million viewers, it exploded in an unprecedented fashion, not with the usual self-serving monologue of an industry insider comedian, but instead by the international best-selling rock band Queen. Watching the biggest movie stars in the world all stand and sing in unison, "We Are the Champions," to start the night was a big moment of validation for music in the movies in general, and Queen in particular. The members of Queen exited the stage after performing "We Will Rock You" and "We Are the Champions," but it wouldn't be the last time they would take the stage that night. You see, for the preceding 8 years, Brian May and Roger Taylor of Queen and their manager had been trying to get a movie made of the life of Queen frontman Freddie Mercury. Seemingly snake-bit at every turn, they lurched through two lead actors, two directors, and lukewarm critical reviews to emerge with the movie Bohemian Rhapsody being the number one box office film in the world last autumn and the holiday season, then winning 4 Academy Awards, including Best Actor, for Rami Malek's portrayal of Freddie Mercury. So just how did this saga unfold? To get noticed in London in 1974, Queen was vying for press attention at a time when the Rolling Stones and Led Zeppelin were neck and neck for world's greatest rock band. Plus, it was the absolute peak for progressive rock bands like Yes and the Moody Blues, and Jethro Tull had number one albums, as well as David Bowie and the glam bands. This I reminded to Queen's Brian May.
Then you were elbowing at the bar for a column in the music press back then.
Well, I don't know. You know, the music press was never our friend. You know, we were always sort of fighting, like you say, with the press, who for some reason thought we were insignificant on the whole, you know, with a couple of exceptions. I don't think we regarded it as a competition, but we had a kind of pioneering spirit. You know, we thought we were great. You know, we were precocious boys. We thought we had something exceptional to offer, and we never questioned it. So internally, we had a great strength, a great belief. But England was very, you know, we were in England. We weren't in the world at that time, really. We hadn't really started in the world. We were just in the UK. And Britain is very fashion conscious. Britain works on waves of fashion, sort of, which seem to be, it still works that way.
Really?
I think. Yeah, I think so. You know, something will be the thing at a particular time, and everybody will jump on a bandwagon, and that will be cool, and nothing else will be cool. So, and to that kind of, in that context, we weren't very cool. We were doing something which was sort of outside whatever the trend was. So we weren't selling thousands and millions of records. But in the live situation, we had a lot of believers, and we were building the live thing. But it doesn't happen overnight. You know, there was no internet in those days. There was you know, things were so different. There was not even any mobile phones when you think about
it. There was no rock on TV in America.
No, there was no, wheels were square in those days, you know.
That's good.
No, but you know, it was vastly different in those days, and we did it what was really the classic way. We did it by constantly touring, constantly playing, partly because we loved it, we liked that feeling, but partly because that was how to pay your dues and that was how to build yourself as a band. And complementing that was the studio album, which happened every year. You know, we would spend probably 3 months making the album and roughly 9 months touring if you check back. That was life for us, and we loved it. We thought we were lucky, and we were.
Yeah. Tell you what, it's time you all joined in. Everybody, it's called Keep Yourself Alive. Yeah.
Yourself Alive, Queen in 1974, with a song originally appearing on their debut album that year, found on the Bohemian Rhapsody soundtrack. Queen has been performing some of these early chestnuts on recent tours, much to the delight of longtime fans such as myself. Queen drummer, singer, songwriter Roger Taylor joined me in the studio.
The thing is, you can draw a straight line from what you were doing after the second album and as Sheer Heart Attack
just
was coming out.
Just before the Sheer Heart Attack album. Yeah.
You can draw a straight line from that to what I just, and what you just performed and I just witnessed last night. That's amazing.
Yeah, I guess it is. I mean, we include in our act now, we're including some of those early songs.
I know.
And the reason is that I had a copy. I hadn't heard this stuff for 40 years. And I had a copy of The Rainbow, Live at the Rainbow. And I had it in my car. I was on the way to rehearsals the first day. And I said, Brian, look, these tracks sound great. You know, why don't we do some of this really ancient stuff? I'd forgotten that we were a really heavy band. We were, you know, before we'd had any hits, sort of pop hits, we were a heavy band. And that really is accentuated on those tracks.
You can hear the progression from when you played The Rainbow in March, which is on disc one as an entire set.
Yeah.
And disc two is November, and I've got written in my notes here, heavier sound in November.
Yeah, yeah.
Evolving.
I think we were definitely evolving between Queen 2 and Sheer Heart Attack, which I think is one of my favorite albums, but I had forgotten that we were a heavy act.
Revered among other guitarists, Brian May is almost criminally under-recognized by the general rock audience. Yet Queen drummer Roger Taylor told me that Brian's extraordinary guitar skills were obvious to Roger from the beginning.
Actually, that's strange. The first time I heard Brian play ever, I remember, I was very particularly impressed with the sort of touch and tone, which was a sort of had a musicality I hadn't heard before. In it's a sort of part, it's touch is part of the sort of tone, isn't it? It's a sort of vibrato thing. It's very, very musical, very melodic style of playing Brian Hess, I think.
It's funny that my recollection is the same of Roger, really. First seeing him tune up his snare. I'd never seen anybody tune a drum before. The drummers I knew just sort of played it the way it came from the shop, I think. So Roger was doing these very very musical rolls on the snare, you know, just before he touched anything else. And I remember thinking, that's, you know, I hadn't heard that kind of thing before. It's strange, we both have the same memories of that. Yes, I think as a band, we're very aware of sound. You know, you can make great, wonderful records, you know, and build in all sorts of arrangements and everything. But if it doesn't sound nice, nobody wants to listen to it. I think it's something which isn't talked about very much these days. You know, the sound quality is vital.
I don't know. I think we did have a certain inbuilt collective arrogance. I think it was the group thing, you know. It was just being a group. Individually, I don't think we were arrogant. But as a group, we thought we could sort of conquer anything. And to have that belief is like a necessary ingredient, I think. I mean, not always the most attractive thing, but I think you have to think that you're good. You know, shrinking violets are unlikely to succeed.
Not in this business.
Here's guitarist, singer, songwriter Brian May.
You were just lads. You were just...
We were just boys. Yeah,
but you were a good live band.
Yeah, I think we were pretty good looking.
And
back
there were no tricks back then.
No, there weren't any tricks to be had, no. It was all live and dangerous, as it is now with us. You know, and we're pretty proud of that. But yeah, we looked back and I think we were a little nervous once the tapes came out of the box, you know, thinking, what on earth are we going to sound like? But Roger and I were both pretty shocked. We thought, yeah, actually, we knew what we were doing in those days. We were very clear and we were very well oiled in a sense. You know, we knew each other already very well. We'd worked hard on getting the coherence of the band. And I think we were lucky. You know, we're lucky that we found each other because nobody could put together a band like that. It had to happen organically. We had to find each other somehow, naturally. And we shared that vision and we shared a work ethic already. And, you know, and we had Freddie.
That was his secret weapon, wasn't it?
Boy, oh boy. But also we had John, you know. People forget, you know, what an extraordinary link in the chain he was. You know, we were very interactive and the four of us all had a great influence on each other and on the eventual outcome. So it was a magical combination and, you know, yeah.
How did that come together that your first time you headlined the Rainbow, that there was people filming it and recording it professionally? That's expensive. It's bulky back then. It was hard to do back then.
Well, I'm not going to claim credit, but we had an overall kind of ethos that it was always worth investing in ourselves and the future. So everything was a gamble. We would... already deeply in debt, but we were always thinking, well, it's worth spending the money now. We don't need to be making money now. We need to be investing in the growth of what we've put together. So there was never any question. And I don't think we made a profit on a tour until the last one, the one wherein we did Wembley, 1986. I don't think we ever made an overall profit because we spent so much on the tour.
Are you serious?
Yeah, that's right. And we were making money off the records. In those days, you could. I don't know if you can these days. Right. But in those days, yeah, we just put everything we could into the tour, investing in great toys and great people. You know, people are worth looking after and paying well, you know. So hopefully we always looked after people. And we always had the state-of-the-art gear and thought it was worth it. And if the balance at the end of the tour was like in the red, that was okay because we sold records and we had the experience and we were building for the future.
She keeps them away, Chandon, in a pretty cabinet. Let them eat cakes, she says, just like Marie Antoinette. A building, a remedy for Khrushchev and Kennedy. At any time, an invitation you can't decline. Caviar and cigarettes, well-versed in etiquette. Extraordinarily nice. She's a killer queen, gunpowder gelatine, dynamite with a laser beam, guaranteed to blow your mind. Ooh, recommended at the price, insatiable and appetite. relations. She never kept the same address. In conversation, she spoke just like a baroness. Middleman from China went down to Geisha Minor. And then again, incidentally, she was in that way. Love you came naturally from Paris. Naturally. Forgot she couldn't care less. Fastidious and precise.
She's a killer queen. Gunpowder, gelatine. Dynamite with a laser beam.
Guaranteed to blow your mind. Momentarily out of action, temporarily out of class, you're absolutely dry. She's out to get you.
She's a killer queen. Gunpowder, gelatine. Dynamite with a laser beam.
Guaranteed to blow your mind. Recommended at the price. Insatiable and appetite.
Wanna try?
That future finally looked a bit brighter in late 1974, according to Queen drummer Roger Taylor.
Suddenly, yeah, you've got a hit, your first one on both sides of the pond with Killer Queen.
With Killer Queen, yeah. And Killer Queen was I think it was a real quality record. And we put a lot of effort into making the harmonies sit right. And they're quite intelligent harmonies. So I think it was a very fine, sophisticated song. And for those reasons, I think it was a fairly unstoppable hit. It just, when we did it, we thought, that sounds like a hit record. And we didn't think about particularly making singles then. We were an albums band. So we never really, we weren't aiming for singles, but just the way that turned out, it just sounded so infectious and
undeniable.
Yeah.
When we return, a dramatic life-or-death story from guitarist Brian May that almost changed the course of rock history, and something which you did not see in the award-winning movie Bohemian Rhapsody. Follow In the Studio on Facebook and online at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard with Queen's Roger Taylor and Brian May in the studio for Bohemian Rhapsody.
This is Roger Taylor here of Queen.
Hi, folks. This is Brian May speaking to Redbeard. We're in the studio.
Truth be told, history came perilously close to being rewritten for Queen that summer 74. Here's guitarist, singer, songwriter Brian May.
Plus, I got very sick. You know, there was all that going on. You know,
what happened?
I somehow got hepatitis when we were doing that first support tour with Mott the Hoople.
Oh, with Mott. And so how do you deal over the spring and summer with a serious illness?
Well, we got to New York, which was one of the pinnacles, and did the Eurus Theatre, thank God. Sort of a Broadway kind of expedition for Mott, which we shared. And, you know, it was good of them to share it with us, really. And then off we went to Boston, and I woke up completely yellow.
Oh, my.
And feeling really, really bad.
Jaundiced.
Yeah, and nobody knows how it happened. I don't know how I got that hepatitis.
Oh, it happens just from close quarters. It happens to kids when they go away to college and they live in a dorm room together.
Yeah.
It happens.
So they shipped me back home, and that was the end of that tour, which was really sad for everybody. But, you know, everyone dealt with it really well. I didn't get any resentment from the rest of them. And then following that, I was sort of recovering from that, and then we started work on the album, and I was thrown up few times a day.
Oh, man.
And we started thinking, well, this is not the hepatitis. I'm sort of over that. What is this? And I ended up on the floor of this specialist's clinic in a bad way. And he said, I think we'd better take you in. And in King's College Hospital, they operated on me the next day because I had basically an extreme form of ulceration of the stomach.
Mm.
And it was
you
extreme.
You can die from that.
I would have died without a doubt.
Bleed internally.
Yeah, well, not just that, but also, if you want to know the details, there was so much ulceration, which had been going on since I'd been a child, apparently.
Really?
That nothing was getting through my body, basically. God. So I was eating food, and it couldn't get out, so it had to come back up. Are you enjoying this explanation?
Bless your heart.
Yeah, so I was in a... No wonder I was in a pitiful state, you know. So they fixed it up. They sort of re-plumbed my insides. And
I didn't realize that you'd had surgery.
Between these
two dates and done a studio... Your best studio album to date in Sheer Heart Attack.
Yeah, well, there's an irony in the Sheer Heart Attack title there, you know, because I owe my life to those people.
Wow.
In King's College. Yeah, so that was quite serious, and I was in hospital, and we were halfway through the album, so Freddie and Roger and John would pop in and make me laugh, which would almost
hurt.
Kill me because I had this huge incision down my middle.
Don't make me laugh.
Yeah, don't make me laugh, guys. Oh, thanks. And but they brought me in the tapes of what they were doing, and they were continuing with the record. But I remember Freddie saying, "Don't worry, darling. You know, we're not going to finish it without you. We need you back." Freddie was great. He was very supportive, always. You know, he's very caring.
Thank you.
Spectacular live performance by Queen of Now I'm Here, originally on the Sheer Heart Attack album, live in London's Hammersmith Odeon, and included on the Bohemian Rhapsody movie soundtrack. You may be surprised to know that outselling the Rolling Stones, Led Zeppelin, Pink Floyd, and yes, even the Beatles, as the most popular British band worldwide. Nevertheless, Queen were never very well received by the critics. Here's Roger Taylor.
The English music press was a very strange animal. It was both powerful and fiercely fashion conscious. It would switch allegiances in a few days, and very vitriolic. And I think that was the way that the young journalists in the English music press, they saw themselves as the creators of a scene.
Kingmakers.
And I think...
Or in your case, queenmakers.
Yeah, exactly. And I think they sort of used this sort of sarcasm and vitriol to sort of show off as writers, I think, really. And it was more about presenting themselves as witty observers of the zeitgeist than it was actual really meaningful criticism, you know. So I take it all with a pinch of salt.
Of course. Now, just before you did that March show at the Rainbow in 74... you had done a rather high-profile tour in support of Mott.
Yes, yeah.
Do you remember some of the reviews that Queen got as on the same stage with Mott?
Well, I just remember the tours being such fun.
Oh, good.
And such a learning experience for us. Obviously, you know, we tried to give them a run for their money every night, but they were a good live act.
They had a very partisan crowd.
Yeah, absolutely.
Loved them to death.
Yeah, and actually who we went down pretty well with, you know. But it was great. It was a learning experience for us as well. We did learn from them. Ian Hunter, their lead singer, had a great sense of drama and theatrical presentation in a totally rock and roll context. And we loved that. And I think we probably nicked a bit of that, you know. And simple lighting ideas, you know, which not a lot of people were aware of at the time.
Queen guitarist Brian May credits an earlier tour supporting Mott the Hoople as very educational in several ways.
With Mott the Hoople, you know, Mott were great for us. They were a great example for us as to how you live on the road. You know, how to be a rock star. A few easy lessons. They were fabulous, Mott. I mean, I feel sad, actually, when I think of Mott, because they should have been the biggest band in the world at some point. You know, and they blew it by splitting up. You know, that's rule number one. You do not split up, you know, because you have to realize that as a group you're greater than the sum of your parts. You know, and it's classic. They were fantastic on that tour. I remember watching them do All the Way from Memphis in Memphis, and the place erupted. You know, it was just, they were insane. And,
that's the night that after the show, Ian went to Graceland and went over the fence.
Yes, that's right.
One of the best stories I ever
heard.
That's
a good story. There's some stories which have never been told, really, about what happened in the Holiday Inn next to the Mississippi down there. It was incredible, you know, and it blew all our minds. And we sort of were baptized into the world of living on the road as rock and roll heroes, I was going to say. We weren't exactly heroes in those days, but it was fantastic because we were pitched right into the middle of it. And on and off stage, it was full on, 1,000,000% full on rock and roll.
Anybody find me?
Somebody to Love, originally on the 1976 album A Day at the Races. Still to come, Brian May gives his personal insight into the creative genius of Queen's Freddie Mercury, while Roger Taylor reveals that immediately prior to their worldwide breakthrough, A Night at the Opera, Queen were broke and threatened with being dropped by their record label. I'm Redbeard, in the studio for the four-time Academy Award winner, Bohemian Rhapsody by Queen.
Hi, this is Roger Taylor of Queen in the studio.
Hello, folks. This is Brian May speaking to Redbeard, and I'm in the studio for Queen.
Thanks again, mates. Brian May surprised me when he shared that Freddie Mercury didn't always exude the confidence and command of the stage for which he is now legendary with Queen.
He was the youngest in the old days when we formed. He was much younger than we were, like 4 or 5 years, I think. And he was just finishing his first degree at college, whereas we were finishing our PhDs and stuff. So he was kind of more reserved. He always waited for the rest of us to say that he could do something for many years. And gradually he came out and started saying, I want to do this, I want to do that. And he started, in the beginning he didn't write anything for the band. I think the first couple of albums he didn't. And then he started writing a couple more and more, and his confidence grew.
By the time Queen had revolutionized rock recording with such dense, layered albums as A Night at the Opera and A Day at the Races in the mid-70s, Brian May said Queen pulled a 180 in the studio.
English traditional recording at that time was everybody has to be sealed off from everyone else. You know, the guitar has to be in this little cubicle, the drums have to be hidden away in this place which is totally deadened, you know, and there's no way that anything shall meet except when it gets on the tape. And I thought it would be fun to do it opposite and just set up all in the studio so we can all see each other and hear each other and play. So you wouldn't be able to change anything, but you would get the live feel. And Mike Stone was engineering, and he was very into it and thought, yeah, why don't we do this? Because that's obviously what people did in the old days, and it used to work. Why doesn't it work now? So we did it one day, set up just, you know, within about a 5-foot radius of each other and played the thing. And I didn't have the song complete at the time. We had just a verse and a chorus, and I said, just try it like this, having played it over to them. And Mike, luckily, had the tape rolling. And the first time we played it through, it had a certain sort of feel. We went and listened to it into the control room, and it sounded great. And we thought, that's exact. I mean, we all loved it and thought it sounded natural and had a nice feel to it. And the sounds were warm, and you could feel that everything was in the same room. You know, we'd always said that was going to be the quick one, because A Night at the Opera and A Day at the Races had been so complex and so layered that we said we want to just do a quick one and see what comes out, you know, something which is very straightforward. And it's strange. A lot of people said afterwards, you know, oh, you're kind of following the punk trend or whatever, you know. But actually that was in our minds before any of that happened, and it was going alongside that. And I remember doing We Will Rock You and all that sort of stuff in Wessex Studios in North London. And the Sex Pistols were being tried out in the studio next door, and the guy was saying, I can't record these guys, they can't play, you know, it's a waste of time. and I remember Fred meeting Sid Vicious, you know, and he said, are you Simon Awful or something, instead of Sid Vicious. Fred couldn't remember what his name was, and he said, yeah, something like that. I can't remember the exact details, but we were already doing, for some reason, it just had hit us that way. We were already doing stuff which was very sort of sparse and minimal, and a sort of rejection of the fussiness which we'd got into in A Night at the Opera and A Day at the Races. That's not to say I don't like those albums, I do. But at that time, we thought it was good to try the other way. So News of the World was really, get back in there, let's play and do something which is raw and recaptures some of perhaps that first album sort of instant magic, you know.
Okay. This is called Fat Bottom Girls. Ah, you gonna take me home tonight? Ah, down beside your red firelight. Ah, you gonna let it all. World go round. Yeah.
Queen live in Paris with Fat Bottomed Girls from the Bohemian Rhapsody soundtrack. One of the marvels of this band's almost half century of live performances are the extremely high quality recordings of live gigs, which were made practically from day one. Here's Roger Taylor.
I mean, there's more technology in your phone now than there was in all of our trucks put together, you know, in those days.
Hard to imagine.
And lighting as well. It's all the same, you know. Everything is smaller, more efficient, and.
But the check, you know, the check wasn't in the mail yet. The bank account wasn't
check
full.
Check wasn't in the mail this for a long time.
This is exactly, and this is expensive and bold, and someone has to really commit. If you recall going into Night at the Opera, you guys were busted, broke. You were skint.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I remember we had very little. A Night at the Opera, I mean, the fact that the Sheer Heart Attack was a hit album, quite a big hit, we didn't see any money. And I think that, you know, it just sort of magically disappeared. into our manager's swimming pool, I think. Into our manager's swimming pool and his new Rolls Royce. But so when we recorded A Night at the Opera, we were broke, so it was such a gamble. And we knew that this is it, you know, this better work. And especially with a song like Bohemian Rhapsody, it's such a chance to take.
Before Freddie Mercury passed away in 1991, Brian May gave me his assessment of Freddie's creative genius.
Now, Freddie is, he's very complex in that, in a way, Freddie is the catalyst for a lot of what happens in the band. You know, he's often something will be sort of happening and Freddie will be sitting there going, okay, and not saying very much. And then suddenly he will say, yeah, but if we do it this way, then it's going to be something new. And we all go, yeah, you're probably right. You know, he has a way of just twisting whatever is happening and putting it on a different basis and making it exciting. He has a kind of vision about what is new and interesting to me. That's the great thing about Fred. He has this slight sort of inner vision which most of us don't have. I don't know what it is, but he will do things in a slightly different, you know, he will find a different slant on things which make it special. And he's got a wonderful voice which he seems to extend every year. He gets more range and more power, more control and more expression. I think he's a great singer. And he has a way of just pulling it out of the hat as well. Most of that stuff, I mean, we throw away tons of material, but, you know, in the way of songs and stuff, because you kind of refine it down to just putting out the best. But a lot of the vocals that you hear are first time, you know, 90% of it will be just what came out the first time, because he has a way of just feeling it at the time, and he doesn't want to change it, and none of us want to change it, you know. He just has a magic of the moment. Yeah, he's just great to work with. He's always stimulating. It's become more intense throughout the years, I think, really. You know, he's kind of, I don't know what it is. There's something that happens, particularly if I work with Freddie, you know, I'm very aware of that. You know, I'll be doing stuff and I get very absorbed in the technicalities sometimes, and Phil's like, hey, hang on, you know, you don't need to do that. There's something you did back there which was much better. You did it by accident, but that's what we need. And I'll go, yeah, probably you're right. And he just has a kind of vision on those things. He's very, very, very stimulating to work with, very inspiring.
Is this the real life? Is this just fantasy? Caught in a landslide, no escape from reality. Open your eyes, look up to the skies and see. I'm just a poor boy, I need no sympathy. Because I'm easy come, easy go, little high, little low. Anyway the wind blows, doesn't really matter. Just killed a man, put a gun.
Queen's guitarist, singer, songwriter Brian May saves his final word for his mate of half a century, Roger Taylor.
Well, me and Roger, We two have been together the longest out of the band because we were in this group called Smile beforehand, which was with Tim Staffel, my old friend, as a singer. So Roger and I have been together the longest, and I guess we are a bit like brothers. We fight like brothers, I know that much. You know, if there's ever an argument, we'll always be on opposite sides of it, no matter what it is. And there's a certain, I think there's a sort of competitive jealousy between us, you know, just which is there. But we're now old enough to understand it and deal with it. And I think we've been a lot closer this last couple of years. We've also been through very similar private situations, you know, great difficulties in sort of staying true to your beliefs in the face of what's going on in your private life, you know. So we've had a lot to talk about, you know, in love life, etc. And it's funny, you go through, I mean, all of the band have been through great changes in their close personal relationships, and the one thing which is constant is the band. So in the end, the band, Queen, is much more of a family to us than anything else. It's very strange, you know, so we find ourselves, you know, a lot of water having run under the bridge, and we still understand each other probably better than ever. So Roger and I don't actually fight as vindictively as we used to do. I mean, there are times still, but mainly we get on pretty well. We're sort of complementary, I would say, to each other, in complementary as opposed to complimentary, if you know what I mean. We're like opposite sides of the same person. Roger is much more outgoing than I am, very uninhibited, you know, and his whole lifestyle is to be a rock and roll star. Whereas mine has been kind of, a lot of the time, I've been kind of treasuring that part of me which wasn't a rock star. I never wanted to become a standard rock person. I wanted to be myself, you know, and I wanted to be private. And the way things have worked out, neither of us were able to sort of keep to what we wanted to be, because things take you over, you know, so you become this strange mixture. And I suppose we ended up being a lot closer than we had been before. We've both been trashed in the newspapers in England to a great extent. And the newspapers are very, very powerful in England. It's like the National Enquirer, but multiplied by 10. You know, they can really destroy your life in England. So we've both been through all that sort of stuff, which Freddie had actually been through a couple of years before. And John also, to a lesser extent, although he managed to sort of hide away a bit from them. But getting back to Roger, you know, Roger is, he has a lot of optimism and a lot of strength, and a damn good drummer.
In his poignant acceptance speech for Best Actor, playing Freddie Mercury, Rami Malek pointed out that he was himself a first-generation immigrant who portrayed a gay immigrant in his role of Freddie Mercury in Bohemian Rhapsody. It's taken 25 long years, but I think Bohemian Rhapsody's greatest accomplishment is once again focusing the world on Freddie Mercury's remarkable life rather than the circumstances of his death. I'm Redbeard. I'll be back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking my guests Brian May and Roger Taylor. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions, copyright 2019. All rights reserved. Transcription by Jane Carpenter Brunet. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook and online at inthestudio.net.